Well, welcome to another episode of the Control Alt Army podcast. And we are joined by a very, very special guest today, the Secretary of the Army herself, Christine Wormuth. Secretary, thanks for being with us this afternoon.
Happy to be here.
In this series that we've recorded over the last several months, we've had commanders talk about why cyber issues are important for commanders of the future to learn about and to own responsibility for, not just delegate to someone else. But this is a very special treat to actually get to talk to everybody's boss's boss's boss and hear a little bit about your career evolution and how you got to be Secretary of the Army and what life is like in that job. So could we just start, if you wouldn't mind, helping our audience understand your role as the Secretary and what a day in the life is for you, with the audience in mind of those who maybe have never worked in the Pentagon?
Sure. Well, the job of the Secretary of the Army is basically to run the entire Army. So it's my job to make sure that we are properly organized, that we are sufficiently manned, and that we are appropriately equipped for current conflicts, current crises, but also future battles. So it's a big responsibility. Most of the legal authority resides in the Secretary of Army position, but of course I share many of my responsibilities with my four-star uniformed partner, General Randy George, the Chief of Staff of the Army. So we, you know, very much, I would say, function as a team, though most of the legal authority resides in the secretary position. And for me, you know, there's really no typical day as the Secretary of the Army. Every day is different. Every week is different. This week, for example, we're in the middle of Program Objective Memoranda, otherwise known as the POM. We are building the five-year budget, the 26 through 30 budget for the Army. So I will be getting some briefings on what the five-year plan looks like for both funding associated with all of our installations, but also funding associated with our equipment. I'm doing this podcast with you. I'm getting ready for a big meeting, an all-day meeting with the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs tomorrow. I'm going to be meeting with a member of Congress on Thursday to talk with him about how the Army is transforming for the future. I'm going to Texas in a couple of weeks to do a ribbon cutting for a brand new factory in Mesquite, Texas, that's going to help manufacture 155 millimeter artillery shells. And I will be seeing the future long range assault helicopter that Bell Textron is building for the Army. So there's a lot of variety on any given day, any given week.
So I guess the tweet summary would be, you think you're busy, try keeping up with the Secretary of the Army for a couple days, let alone a couple weeks or months. So that's amazing. From civil-military relationship with the chief to a lot of external-facing work with the SecDef, industry, Congress, and then actually running the Army internally. That is a one heck of a span of control. Could I then take you back to coming into the Department of Defense as what I understand was then called the Presidential Management Internship, now called the Presidential Management Fellowship, for those who might be looking on the outside and wanting to apply yourself, look for a Presidential Management Fellowship. What drew you to public service? And as our audience may be mostly military, could you walk us through how that pathway worked for you to come into the Department of Defense?
I think I certainly knew relatively early on that I was very interested in foreign affairs and foreign policy. My mom ran the English as a Second Language program at Texas A&M University, so I grew up around a lot of foreign exchange students, if you will. And I think that opened my eyes to, you know, different cultures, different forms of government. So I would say from a pretty early age, I was interested in that. As I went through college, my interests got more focused around national security. And so I went to graduate school at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy. And part of the reason I went there was they had a very strong national security program. And that's really where I started getting more focused on going into government. I would highly recommend the Presidential Management Fellowship Program to any listeners who are currently in graduate school and thinking about government service. It's a program that can open doors to government, not just in the national security foreign policy space, but across the entire government, the domestic agencies as well. It's a fantastic program. And I was fortunate enough to be chosen for the Office of Secretary of Defense PMF program. And, you know, I would say from the minute I walked into the Pentagon and went to the Joint Staff to work on NATO enlargement, I sort of knew I'd found my forever home. And have been in and out of this building pretty much ever since.
Got it. At that time, late 90s, early aughts, do you have a sense, was there talk at that time of computer network operations or cybersecurity? I mean, obviously after 9/11, very focused on war on terror and the sophistication of adversary computer network operations was not top of mind. But just reflecting back, was that at all in the ether of discussion in terms of future transformation?
It was in the ether. You know, not a lot of people remember this because, of course, after the 9/11 attacks, the entire focus of the national security community, you know, went to terrorist threats to the homeland in particular. But before the 9/11 attacks, Donald Rumsfeld, you know, he was the Secretary of Defense, and he came into this department planning to put his stamp on the department by basically through the revolution in military affairs. He really believed that, you know, the Soviet Union had collapsed, you know, we were sort of reshaping our military, and he was very focused on wanting to try to make the United States military more high tech. And a piece of that was cyber. It was very, very early. But if you look at some of his early speeches and if you look at some of the preliminary work we were all doing here in the Department of Defense for the Quadrennial Defense Review, it was focused on the revolution in military affairs. But, you know, suddenly we became extremely focused on a relatively, you know, low-tech set of adversaries. But over time, as you know well, Michael, you know, the focus on threats to the homeland did cause us to start thinking about cyber and thinking about cyber attacks.
I think that's a great point to frame it around those threats to the homeland, because so often I think those who learn about what the government does on cyber war and cyber operations focus so much on offense. But what I take away from your last comment is we're also a very early recognition of vulnerability to the homeland as well. That's, I think, often lost in the conversation early. For those who are looking for research projects, if you're at NDU or Army War College listening, the late 90s, early aughts, and understanding cyber issues, that sounds like a fun project to dig into. And I hope someone out there can get to work on it. You mentioned the Quadrennial Defense Review work that you had done and how cyber issues were starting to play then. But could I take you forward to 2014 when you become Undersecretary of Defense for Policy? And for those, again, who haven't worked in the Pentagon, that is the top policy job in this building and the Department of Defense. That portfolio is massive. Every region of the world, plus a host of functional responsibilities from space issues, but also cyber issues increasingly as well. Could you help listeners understand how a very busy senior executive like you at that point takes on overseeing and managing something like a technical field like cyber issues in a very, very busy portfolio? It's kind of a leadership reflection question, I guess.
Sure. I would say, you know, when I was Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, there were really sort of three pieces to the cyber portfolio at that time. One piece of it was thinking about sort of offensive cyber operations and, you know, how we might be using cyber tools and capabilities in current crises. So, for example, the counter-ISIS campaign was underway from 2014 to 2016, and there a significant element of that campaign involved the cyber domain. And so part of, you know, in interfacing then with Admiral Rogers, who was dual-hatted as the director of NSA and also U.S. cyber commander, I could leave the technical details and expertise to him and to his team, but it was part of my responsibilities to think sort of at the strategic level, how could that set of tools be applied as one element of a campaign against an adversary. Another piece that was, you know, called on me, frankly, as a leader to have a little bit more knowledge of some of the specific pieces of the cyber domain and cyber capabilities was part of my responsibility as undersecretary was also interfacing with the services, with the military departments, and helping them think through how are they going to develop their cyber, not just capabilities, but their cyber workforce. And you will remember, you know, at that time, this was all still relatively new, and we were still in the process of developing the cyber mission forces, the cyber support teams. We were trying to talk about roles and responsibilities and how would we do this and what kinds of capabilities would they have and how would the services budget for all of that. And again, that to a certain extent required me to get more involved in the details, but you know, in all good large organizations, you have a hierarchy. And I had a DASD at that time for, if I recall, we had a DASD for cyber and space. We did not yet have separate deputy assistant secretaries, much less a whole assistant secretary for cyber, which we will soon have. But there were people at the deputy assistant secretary level and below who had that kind of much more technical expertise. And I've always been a believer as a leader, go to where the expertise is. A, don't pretend to have expertise that you don't have, particularly on the technical side, and don't be embarrassed about, you know, reaching down into an organization to the people who do have that technical expertise. You know, my view is go to where the expertise is and don't be afraid to sort of surface that and leverage that.
That's great. I actually still remember an evening. It was later on in the evening when I was sitting over in the cyber policy office. You were undersecretary, and there was a question that you had, and you surprise attacked us over the DTC over the Tamberg, and you know, got all of us there with a good question. But it was a great example of, you know, just go right to people who you felt, you know, could help resolve a question top of mind. And it was fun to be on a team that could do that for you. Could I then ask, so you, after that experience as Undersecretary for Policy, you go to RAND. Could you tell our audience a little bit about what RAND is like, what an FFRDC, a federally funded, I won't do spelling in public, Research and Development Corporation. What does that really do as a partner for government and your experience there?
FFRDCs like RAND are essentially what I would call think tanks for government. And one way the FFRDCs like RAND, Institute for Defense Analyses, MITRE, are different from, you know, the downtown think tanks in D.C. is they have the capability to do classified work, which particularly for cyber projects, you know, can be very, very important. Also, something that RAND offers that I think is pretty unique is just an incredibly deep bench of multidisciplinary experts. So a lot of think tanks in town, you know, may have a lot of people with backgrounds similar to my own, where you're a political scientist or a public policy, and, you know, maybe you've been sort of a generalist that's done a lot of different things over the years. An FFRDC like RAND has many, 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 many experts with PhDs in some very technical disciplines, you know, who are deeply, deeply expert, and RAND can bring those people together. They can partner technical experts with, you know, even medical professionals or, you know, with the sort of more traditional public policy people, if you will. And that kind of ability can be very, very powerful for customers inside the government like myself.
Got it. And you had previously been involved with some critical infrastructure. You were the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Homeland Defense before, and if I understand your time at RAND, you got to work on some additional Homeland Defense-related work there as well at RAND.
Yes, I've been interested in Homeland Defense and Homeland Security for a very long time, even frankly prior to the 9/11 attacks, and that's kind of been a thread that's carried through my professional career. And when I was at RAND, actually the Office of Net Assessment here in the Pentagon reached out to RAND and asked us to do some classified research looking at conventional threats from nation states to the United States. And they asked us to really focus on non-nuclear threats. So really what we were looking at when we sort of scoped the research, we really focused on missile attacks, you know, whether it was ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and cyber attacks on critical infrastructure. And so I spent a lot of time in my last year at RAND with a multidisciplinary team digging into that. And it was a fascinating, although I will admit very sobering project to lead and be a part of.
The results of that does sound like something that would keep you up at night.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's fair to say that if there were ever an all-out war between the United States and, you know, a near-peer nation state like Russia or China, those are two countries that, as you know well, you know, have very, very sophisticated cyber capabilities. And I fully believe, and, you know, the Russians even have a pretty explicit doctrine which talks about escalating to de-escalate. I fully believe that as part of an all-out war, either one of those countries would contemplate cyber attacks on the United States homeland, things like our transportation networks, things like our power grid. And that, you know, would have, I think, some very profound consequences that we would have to deal with.
So that's a pretty clear case for those listening and wondering, you know, could I come into government and work on interesting things in cybersecurity or cyber operations? And I think you just heard the secretary say not just yes, but heck yes. So, you know, I think in terms of the clarity of the really powerful work you can do in government on cyber issues, that's a great case. For the last question as we come to a close here, Secretary, could you talk a little bit about now being Secretary of the Army, some reflections on why working for the Army, joining the Army for either a career or just for a few years for our listeners is really something to consider as folks think about their careers and what to do next?
I think the most powerful reason to join the Army or to serve in, you know, any of the military branches, and frankly, whether you serve in uniform or whether you come in as a civilian hire, and the Department of the Army has lots of civilian employees, the most powerful thing the Army offers is the opportunity to be part of something that's bigger than yourself, to be part of defending our great country. And, you know, I think if you feel a sense of mission, if you feel sort of a calling to service, the Army offers that in a way that I think very few organizations do. And so many times I run into people who have gotten out of uniform or who are no longer serving in government. And whatever they're doing and enjoying, they still speak very wistfully about, you know, missing that sense of being part of the team and being part of something that's larger than yourself. So I think that's the most compelling reason to join the Army. But I would also say, you know, as you know well, Michael, there are things you can do, particularly in the cyber realm, as a government employee and as someone serving in an Army uniform that you can't do anywhere else, that literally is not legal. You know, we can do things in terms of hunt forward missions, for example, or, you know, other kinds of offensive cyber operations that you can't do in the outside world. And there's an incredibly important protection mission, not just of our DoD infrastructure, but also partnering with the rest of government, with the commercial sector to defend our critical infrastructure. So I think those are all a set of things that are very, very powerfully attractive, even if, you know, we will always struggle to be competitive dollar for dollar, you know, with the big companies that are out there.
Outstanding. I'm on board. You've recruited me. So I'm thrilled to be with the Army and to be able to have opportunities like this to talk to you about your reflections on being secretary and the importance of cyber issues and this podcast in general as a way for folks in the schoolhouses and elsewhere to hear from leaders about why these issues really are worthy of study. So thank you so much for joining us today. And we look forward to another episode with another guest soon.
Thanks for having me.